Okay, so people are still joining, by the way. Great. Okay, so dear honorable guests, welcome to another monthly meeting of our network. As your host today, I am delighted and honored to introduce you today's speaker, Professor Julian Milley. Julian is a professor of Indonesian studies here at Monash, a wonderful colleague and a mentor of mine, and one of the founding members of this beautiful platform. Julian was trained in anthropology, and his research chiefly focuses on the political and social meanings of Islamic practice in Indonesia. He has a long list of publications that you can find on his website, and I will put the link to his website through the chat. I just want to draw your attention to his latest article published recently. It's titled Men's Politics and Women's Piety, the Gendered Asymmetry of Indonesia's New Public. Last year, Julian was awarded the highly prestigious Fellowship of Australian Academy of the Humanities as an acknowledgement of his multifaceted contributions into scholarship. So we are very honored to have you here today with us, dear Julian. Julian's talk today is titled Islamic Critiques of Materiality in Indonesian Reformism. After his talk, we will stop the recording and we will have around 10 minutes for conversations, for questions and answers. Thank you very much once again for joining us, dear Julian. And I will now leave the floor to you. Thank you once again.
Okay. Sorry, guys. Please allow me to fumble momentarily. Okay, thank you very much, Pak Kiai. I call Aidohan Kiai, which is the Indonesian word for a head of a religious school. We have these nicknames around here that we use. And for organizing this fantastic forum on an ongoing basis, it's truly a unique forum. And thank you all for coming and listening. So I'm an Indonesianist, as Aidohan just said. But my specialization has been in Islamic practice. And I'm going to the topic that I'm talking about today is maybe not squarely on a topic that's obviously to do with tasawwuf or Sufism, but I think you'll see that it is very relevant to understandings of Sufism in Indonesia and elsewhere as well. Now, this picture I've started with here, it's kind of allowing me to establish the direction of where we're going today. So this is a kind of Islamic women's fashion magazine in Indonesia, which is a fairly recent thing, recent decades. Probably the 1990s was the start of this magazine. And you'll see that this is, halal fashion, or fashion that enables women to fulfill their interpretations of their religious obligation as far as dress goes, and at the same time do something else. Let's just say be fashionable or and what I'm interested in is the materiality of that. So about 2 years ago, some colleagues and I, we had a collaboration with the University of Indonesia about Islamic consumption in Indonesia. And my topic ended up being about reformist Islam and how reformist intellectuals perceived Islamic consumption and materialism. And this, and here's where the Sufism comes into it, because I've of course brought that topic into my longer term research trajectory. And materiality of religious practice has been a massive thing for me. So in 2002, 2003, I spent about 14 months attending a ritual in West Java where people gather to sing and listen to karamat, so which we could say, and the particular wali who is celebrated in this part of the world is Abdul Qadir al-Jailani, who of course is everybody's familiar with this Abdul Qadir, who was born in the, he was born in the 11th century of the common era in Jailan, which is just south of the Caspian Sea, but he had a glittering career as a teacher in Baghdad, and his tomb is in Baghdad now. His reputation as an intercessor grounds a lot of ritual practice around the whole world. And in In Bandung, the city in West Java where I researched that, this is called manakiban. So manakib is, we could say, is a literary form. And this is the kind of books that are read there. The picture on the left, that's Abdul Qadir. And you'll see that the person who made this, I don't know whether they had seen those famous pictures of Nizamuddin, where he's got the Indian, quite obviously Indian design and fabric on the outside, but the inside is Al-Quran or Hadith or obviously Arabic text. So this is the same here. This is a batik sort of fabric. And it, the text there says Sheikh Muhyiddin, which is Abul Qadir Nalika Ankat Jumpa Soli Putra Sharif Wahab, which means when he set out to meet Soli Putra bin Sharif Wahab wearing silk, Ngango Sutra Sutra. Now the language, this is the language here we're dealing with, is Sundanese, which is one of the ethnic languages of Indonesia. Now, so I attended this ritual for about 14 months, and it's really material religion at every level. The ritual involves food, incense, all kind of ritual significations. And of course, it's also strictly very material in the verbal sense. Words are a materiality, and especially in this part, in this kind of ritual, the words, you'll sit listening for hours and hours and hours. So it's incredibly dense and rich and effulgent in the verbal aspect of materiality. So I spent a year doing that. And then for this particular project, though, I wanted to look at how Indonesian reformists viewed materiality, because I think it's a misunderstood topic. Also, it's fascinating in the sense that the development and dynamism of religious positions, public and private, very much correspond to different notions about the importance of objects, whether those objects are words, clothes, like we saw in the first slide, food, and so forth. Now, so I did a lot of reading, mainly reading about intellectual products of Indonesian reformists. This is Ahmad Dahlan, and Indonesian reformism will follow, in broad ways, it follows many of the models that we find in Egypt and other parts of the world. So Indonesians at this time were living under a colonial government. The Republic of Indonesia emerged in 1945. So for a very long period of time, there was no social welfare. There was no notion of the welfare state in the Republic of Indonesia. So it fell to Islamic organizations to be amongst the first. There were others that were non-religious in the Netherlands Indies to provide the kind of social welfare infrastructure that they observed people enjoying in the colonized countries. I mean, they observed that there was a lot of sort of welfare infrastructure in those nations, and that was the role for a lot of reformist organizations. This is Ahmad Dahlan. Muhammadiyah was the 1912. This was formed in Yogyakarta, mainly in an environment of traders where they were very concerned to have equality of a number of different kinds that had been denied to native peoples. And of course, it had an Islamic grounding to it for reformists like Ahmad Dahlan. And so they set about establishing schools. Instantly, as soon as their organization sprang up, they began establishing schools, educational institutions, and then later orphanages and hospitals and so on. So they are establishing this infrastructure before there was a state that was willing to do these kind of things. And they would put themselves in conflict with Islamic traditions that were heavily material, and the materiality was something they instantly objected to, Ahmad Dahlan and other modernists and reformists at that time. And so for Ahmad Dahlan, for example, his theology, apparently, according to the literature, the theology that grounded his thinking was Surah Al-Ma'un, which is, and I've used the interpretation of Pikthal here, and I'm not sure whether that's the best or the right one to use, so I apologize for that. And apparently in his teaching and in his da'wah, This was the Quranic sign that really sort of underpinned his messaging. Now let's have a reading of this. Hast thou observed him who belieth religion? That is, he who repelleth the orphan and urgeth not the feeding of the needy. And woe unto the worshippers who are heedless of their prayer, who would be seen at worship, yet refuse small kindnesses. And in a way, the talk I'm giving today is exploring the effects of this particular teaching for materiality in religion, because they are very far-reaching. Let's think about this here. Okay, there's a message here, and that is that let's not be too overtly concerned with the formalized side of religious practice, and that there are practical works in the real world that in fact are prime at the center of the religious obligation. And this is what this part of Revelation is saying. But of course, this verse also sets up a number of oppositions, doesn't it? It casts doubt upon the religious validity of formalized religious practice and also the materiality that goes with it. And in Indonesia, as in other countries in the world, you do find that this kind of notion of that the true religion is that that is not preoccupied with formal particularism, that is the true religion. And that sets up a very interesting conflict in places like Indonesia. And of course, we're not only talking about Islam here. Christianity, Hinduism have the same internal debates about this kind of thing. So people like Ahmad Dahlan are often referred to as the purifiers and as conducting a project of purification. Of what? Well, one of the things that they were very interested in was the ritual meal. Okay. Now, so the kind of prime form of public religion at the end of the 19th century and the first decades of the 20th century was without doubt the ritual meal. So, and the context within which I observed the ritual reading of Abdul Qadir's Karamat was also the ritual meal. Okay, so we have a textual tradition of Manakib, which is a book containing the amazing proofs of the saintliness and the closeness of Abdul Qadir to Allah. But at the same time, it's brought into an Islamic tradition of the ritual meal. Okay. Now let's look at what the ritual meal actually did. And there's a lot of anthropology about this. So here's an image here. This is actually from Abdul Qadir. Ritual recitation gathering. You can see the food placed in the middle of the people sitting around. And one of the people sitting around will be the reader of the text, who will have the Karamat book there, Manaki book, and will be reciting. So the ritual meal clearly affirms and creates hierarchies. Who can speak? Who has to listen? Who can prepare food? Who gets to eat? Who is a giver? Who is given to? These are hierarchies in societies. It also affirms solidarity, clearly. We're sitting with our neighbours and giving to them, and then we're sitting in their house later on and receiving from them. It's a fulfilment of the obligations to distribute alms and charity, of course, sedeke or sodoka. It creates relations of exchange. So typically in the ritual meal cycles, if you're a guest and you receive, then later you give. And this is still, this is in many Indonesian communities, this is still a kind of structuring cycle for neighborhood sociability, involving also not only the neighborhood, but also involving work and patron and client relations and political relations and so forth. For many people, also the ritual meal offers ways to make invitations to ancestors. So, for example, incense is the most common thing there. What does incense do? Oh, well, it ensures that our messages reach the spirits of ancestors. By no means do all people hold to that understanding, of course. Enjoyment is a big part of it. The Abdul Qadir ritual it's a performance, and quite often you find profane genres for performance are brought into the ritual. And of supplicating for worldly things. And this is probably the most dominant motivation of this kind of the ritual meal sort of religion, is that you can use these technologies to supplicate exams for your children, your business. Muharram is the month in which business people supplicate for the year to come, and people are ill. then you have the ritual meal with the recitation. It's highly particular, this. Which way should we do it? Do it this way. No, that's the wrong way. Okay, so we're making choices about the right way to doing things that involve choices between material objects. This is clearly not Ahmad Dahlan territory, is it? We've seen that his theology was grounded by the Surah Al-Ma'un. The particularity and materiality of it are objectionable. So, for example, how should the chicken be prepared? People care about that. All right, and there are manuscripts and books that specify the correct way to prepare the chicken. Should we fight for the chicken? There's a tradition where at the end of the reading, upon a certain word, makbul, people jump into the food and grab what they can and put into a plastic bag. It's a kind of a game. It's fun. And for some people, the ritual, if you don't do that, don't hold the ritual. So the particularity, of course, is objectionable for some. Is the bread and butter needed? You serve foods that Abdul Qadir ate at these rituals. There has to be bread and butter, even though in West Java, bread and butter are not staple meals at all. So there's this high particular effect in the materiality of the event. And this is the sort of thing that against which Ahmad Dahlan and other reformers brought the Al-Ma'un theology. So let's talk more then about the legacy of Ahmad Dahlan in the Republic of Indonesia and Muhammadiyah. So as I mentioned, they were looking at modern education that was being implemented by other groups and said, we have to go that direction. So Muhammadiyah chose very early to, in inverted commas, secularize religious education in the Republic of Indonesia. And right now they have about 27 universities. They're the biggest private owner of universities in the Republic of Indonesia, and they have extremely high quality. And that's not to mention the orphanages and the old people's homes and other social welfare institutions. They have a disaster, they have a national disaster mobilization service at this point in time. Okay, so you can see how the Surah Al-Ma'un has really become a kind of grounding principle for practical projects that benefit all Indonesians, not just Muslims and not just members of Muhammadiyah. Now, in the 1960s, Indonesia was under authoritarian period. So you had this emergence of a generation of Muslim intellectuals who'd been educated in the secular system. Okay, so what happened was you had a new sort of generation of Muslim intellectual in the Republic of Indonesia. Many of them were social scientists. So in their kind of religious deliberations, they blended their theology with their understandings of Islamic, of Indonesian societies in general. And they were interested in the social sciences. And the two figures I'm going to talk about today, they were probably, I guess you would say that they were sociologists, political sociologists and philosophers, maybe would be their designation. And so they created this intellectual environment that kind of thrived in a situation where they were denied political representation. So the Suharto government, which was toppled in 1998, they were careful to maintain a political monopoly, and Suharto didn't want explicitly Islamic political programs to be part of public life. So they allowed there was one Islamic political party that was allowed to exist throughout that time, which was a kind of tool for controlling Islamic politics. But civil society flourished in that kind of environment. And I'm going to mention two successors of Ahmad Dahlan here, Kunto Wijoyo and Muslim Abdurrahman. They're both recently deceased. And I mention them because they are clearly the two most prominent reformist intellectuals who had things to say about materiality in Islam in Indonesia. And they were very public. They were very concerned with social projects of progress. Now, these guys are reformists who are not in the generation of textual literalists. Okay, so back in the Ahmad Dahlan time, people were saying, look, there's no Abdul Qadir ritual that you're performing here. It doesn't have any validation in the Quran or the Sunnah. This is not these guys' style, okay? So I think we need to recognize that generation. The textual literalists still exist, but I've never found in any of their writings of either of these two any use of Quran or Hadith as justification for making pronouncements about religious practice. Okay, it's all about the that's what we're going to learn about, what it's all about. So Kuntawi Jowa, I'm just going to mention here because of his theology of emancipation. All right. Now, this is the theme that appears frequently in his writings, is that Islam is emancipation. Okay. So let me just read here. According to Islam, human self-actualization can only be formed perfectly in service to the Creator. And this clearly constitutes the true emancipation. As created beings, humans are only allowed to have a relation of servitude to Allah, to the Creator. This concept is intended so that humans can only give service to their Creator, not to the false idols that we see in folklore and mythology. So this, I mean, these kind of statements in a way are sort of, they're common, and the idea of a tawhid that is emancipatory is a common thing. But it involves a lot of thinking about Indonesian Islamic society. And in fact, the challenge to other religious currents within Indonesia put out by this is massive. Okay, so we're all emancipated. Okay, well, what constrains that? That's the obvious question that we have to ask. Kuntawi Jowa would never say that you should be emancipated to do whatever you want. Clearly, there's got to be some constraints on that emancipation. And for him, really, the biggest constraint is a notion of ethical citizenship. Okay. So we're emancipated from Islamic particularity and ritual material and materialism, but we're now clearly subject to a new framework of evaluation that is citizen subjectivity. The state and the Muslim community together have the role of developing Indonesian citizenship mentality. It is relevant that he was writing this at a time when Indonesia were under authoritarian government. But this is nevertheless a continuing theme in all of these scholars. They thought that there was a religious justification for a citizenship ethic, okay? And I mentioned another similar thing from Amin Reis, who was another reformist intellectual who had this kind of social justice understanding of Tawhid. And this brings with it a very radical anti-materialism. All right, so let's focus now on the other figure, Muslim Abdulrahman. So he was a University of Illinois PhD, worked as a tour guide for Hajj and Umrah groups. That was the fieldwork for his PhD project. And like Kuntawi Jowa, who was kind of in some ways a sort of a disciple of Kuntawi Jowa, was younger than him, not by much, but Kuntawi Jowa was a massive figure in the Muhammadiyah movement and in the intellectual side. So the authentic focus of Islamic practice ought to be social and economic inequality for Indonesians. That's what we should all, that Tawhid emancipates us to work on that, not formal observance. And once again, you have a radically anti-particular and anti-material. I want to explore three themes that emerge in Muslim Abdulrahman's conception. And to give you a bit more context, he thrived in that environment of the new intellectualism of the 1980s in Indonesia and the 90s in Indonesia, but he has been influential. There's a network of younger Muhammadiyah scholars who basically formed around him. So one of the more dynamic parts of Muhammadiyah, which exists today, and he's been dead for a while now, is based around his leadership. So he has got this very influential legacy in Indonesia right now. I want to identify three themes in his anti-materialism. The first is to do with the travel guide stuff. And that opening picture that I saw, he thought that material consumption enables people to index their economic status. This is a really kind of gendered view, because that woman we saw in the first slide, then he explicitly accuses those people of using materiality to state their economic position. Okay, so this is not emancipation under the Kuntawi Jowa and Muslim Abdulrahman vision. He saw the middle class veil as an aspect of group symbolic capital for their clothes, create and confirm personal and collective identities. And people haven't really picked up the gender perspective there, but there are writers who take a different perspective about the fashion. The feminist approach to the gendered fashion in Indonesia says, look, these are pious acts, and they cause anxiety to women. Okay. So the women who do them are also, they do so under conditions of anxiety about the correctness of what they do. So it's not really accurate to say that they're just purely indexing their economic status. Okay. We're not going to go down that path in the talk today. Importantly, it was his experience as a guide for Hajj and Umrah pilgrims that gave him this perception, which you can see is influenced by Pierre Bourdieu and other social scientists about materialism. A second point is the fragmentation that he saw as resulting from that. So the semiotics of choice fragment, okay? And this is against ethical citizenship. And this is extremely far-reaching because, so he would say, for example, that if your QA, if your teacher says to do things in a particular way, for example, your salat or your ritual or the way you dress, the way you study, if you're being told to do that in a particular way because that's what is done in your group, that's a fragmenting process and it's politically disadvantageous. It's a really radical perspective that it takes because then any fragmentation based on Islamic difference then becomes harmful. Okay, so for example, he would look around him, and you look at these guys. They do have an appearance that is completely neutral. Okay, and that neutrality is under-recognized, I think, as a Muslim dress style. But the point is that he basically accused Muslims of participating in fragmenting processes when they exercise semiotic preferences that belong to their own environment. The third point is this post-religion awareness. So as I mentioned, group affiliation that has a semiotic dimension to it becomes fragmenting, but except for one group, and that is citizenship. So Kunto Ijoyo and Muslim Abdul Rahman were both radical in their insistence. We've got to be working for the progress of our republic into a plural society. So, and at times he asked for a post-religion awareness. Okay, so the fragmentation that was harmful, he saw a number of times as existing even at the level of religion. And of course he became criticized for this, and someone now and again in Indonesia, people publish the list of the 20 most hated liberals in Indonesian Islam. Muslim Abdul Rahman was inevitably on those lists because of his preparedness to talk about a post-religion awareness as a form of Islamic emancipation. You can understand not everyone's into that argument. And to go back to Muhammadiyah and the legacy of Ahmad Dahlan, Kunto Ijoyo and Muslim Abdul Rahman really stepped back from the notion that Muhammadiyah should be a political party. And this is an ongoing dialectic in those organisations. Okay, we are political because we have an Islamic project in society, but do we need to participate in formal politics? And at the moment, the biggest civil society organisations do have political parties. They maintain a distance from them by saying you can't have a role, you can't have a formal role in the civil society organization if you are involved in formal politics. But nevertheless, the labels of the civil society organizations are mobilized by political parties with the approval of the organization. So for Muslim Abdul Rahman, this was a disaster because it involved the mobilization of particularity in semiotic particularity in Islam. And of course, some of you might have read Charles Taylor's work on the secular age, and it is remarkable how Abdul Rahman and Kunto Ijoyo do follow the patterns of what he calls an exclusive humanism of Charles Taylor's perception. So, Charles Taylor talks about that book about the kind of loss of prestige and credibility about particularistic religion, the idea that divine power can be summoned by particularistic utterances or acts has diminished, and at the same time, the order of mutual benefit has emerged. And Charles Taylor, of course, is very interested in this idea of mutual benefit and the transcendence that seems to come with that. The rejection of the notion of a higher being as it's replaced by a notion of the mutual benefit as the, well, let's use Kunto Ijaya's words, as the true emancipation. So what that means is that the emancipated individual then becomes the kind of the agent in the creation of a moral order. It doesn't exist in some kind of inaccessible or divine realm. This is what Charles Taylor calls the immanent order. So there's a real connection here through these scholars to the Surah Al-Ma'un, isn't there? In the sense that the higher being is dematerialized and the materializations become part of the problem. Yeah, don't they? This is what Charles Taylor points out. If you hold to this notion of mutual benefit as the kind of defining framework for religious subjectivity, then you're going to look at particularistic religion as an impediment, right? So that's a very interesting, I think, perspective on a rather radical Islamic perspective. Charles Taylor, I think, a lot of his analyses fit very well for the modernist traditionalist dialectic in Indonesia, without, of course, the notion of atheism. I mean, no one would ever accuse, people did accuse Muslim Abdulrahman of being an atheist, but I don't think that's sustainable. For one reason, is that in all his writings, he continues to refer to a number of basic Islamic concepts. For example, what is called in Indonesia, Amar Ma'ruf Nahi Munkar. Munkar is in Indonesia, of course, this appears many times in his work. And in a body of work that doesn't really have, like I say, this is a post-Mazhab thinking here. It doesn't really have a lot of references to Islamic sources, but there are a number that appear very often. And they're always defined to mean emancipation. Okay, so... So I don't think he can really be accused of being atheist. But what it does do is it presents a kind of atheist perspective within a religious current. Now, the problem he has is Indonesians love material religion. And this is the other contextual point here that needs to be made. The more and more pure this Muhammadiyah thinking God, at the same time, Indonesians became more and more their preference for material religion, like the woman at the very beginning, but also this, which is a traditional thing. So the Maulid celebration in the city of Yogyakarta, the Sultan prepares a gunungan, a mountain, I think it's called gunungan, a little mountain, which has agricultural produce. People love it. And at the end of the ritual, it's a fight where you get to grab, but young men climb the mountain, and it's a kind of test of sort of masculinity. But also all of these, agricultural produce here is distributed amongst people and taken home. So Indonesians love this kind of materiality. So it must be a frustrating experience to hold to the sort of religious perspective of Muslim Abdulrahman in the Republic of Indonesia at the moment. So why is this important? Look, I think I won't go through all these. I think one thing is we've got to get beyond the stereotype of textual literalism in understanding reformism and modernity. It's beyond that. And I think Surah Al-Ma'un is not often mentioned as for its kind of ambivalent, ambiguous sort of position in this thinking. Also, I find interesting that secular humanism is incorporated within religious currents within the Republic of Indonesia. And the fourth point is that, of course, the critique of tasawwuf, which generally in its practice is heavily material, is substantial from this kind of thing. And when I say that tasawwuf is heavily material, I know that quite often we talk in this forum about Sufism as something that's abstracted from practice. And I think that's no doubt true. But really the current that I'm engaging with and that Muslim Abdulrahman and Kunto Ijaya engage with too, is that material current where it fits into routines of ritual practice. So I think that's enough for me today, and I'm happy to hear people's comments and answer any questions that people might have.